Family Resiliency Center.
I'm Unit 4.
The Urbana Free Library.
And I'm Molly Delaney of Illinois Public Media, and together we're CU Fit Families. Join us and many other organizations in fighting childhood obesity. Call 217-333-7300 or email delaney1@illinois.edu.
It's 2:40 in sports. Illinois tries to extend its postseason run tonight against Dayton in the quarterfinals of the NIT. Tip-off is 8 o'clock in Assembly Hall. That comes after Rhode Island is up against Virginia Tech at Virginia Tech in tonight's other quarterfinal. Tomorrow night, the Illinois women will tip off against Missouri State at Missouri State in round 3 of the WNIT. That game starts at 7:05. Illinois State will host Kansas. Northwestern faces Big Ten rival Michigan tomorrow. In the NBA tonight, Indiana will host Washington. In hockey, the Blues are at Detroit. Major League Baseball this afternoon, it's, the Cardinals and the Orioles are done now. Cardinals beat the Orioles 4-2 in a just-completed game. The Braves lead the Phillies 4-0 in the bottom of the seventh. The Red Sox beat the Pirates, or lead the Pirates, I should say, 6-1, that game in the bottom of the eighth. And it's the Rays leading the Blue Jays 5-3 in the top of the eighth. The Twins beat the Marlins today 4-1. Among games underway tonight, or underway in about a half hour, I should say, into this evening, the Cubs will be playing Texas and the White Sox will play Arizona. First pitch in both of those games a little after 3 o'clock. Major League Baseball made a minor change to its postseason schedule, eliminating an off day in the middle of the league championship, rather and moving it ahead of the LCS opener. The change announced today was the first made at the recommendation of the Special Committee for On-Field Matters, appointed in December by Commissioner Bud Selig. The players' union agreed to the switch and said it will attempt to further condense the schedule starting in 2011. The change will not cut the length of the postseason. The playoffs will start October 6th, and the World Series begins October the 7th. And the NFL and NFL Alumni Association have established a neurological care program for retired players designed to address quality of life issues. The plan makes available to former players neurological specialists at 5 medical centers. NFL Alumni Association Executive Director George Martin says the doctors will evaluate and treat possible neurological conditions. The participating medical centers include Barnes Hospital in St. Louis. Illinois Public Media is part of the College of Media at Illinois. It is 2:43 on the Afternoon Magazine. I want to mention that tomorrow afternoon in this time slot, Jeff Bossert will be sitting in, and we will hear from character actor Stephen Tobolowsky. The name may be more recognizable through some of the characters he's played, most notably that of insurance salesman Ned Ryerson in the Bill Murray movie Groundhog Day. Jeff Bossert will interview Tobolowsky about his career in nearly 200 films and TV shows and his weekly podcast that includes stories of his years as a grad student at University of Illinois in the early 1970s. That'll be in this hour of the Afternoon Magazine tomorrow.
Support for the Environment Report comes from the Park Foundation, the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation, and the Great Lakes Fishery Trust. You can find more stories and post your comments at environmentreport.org.
The humble Buffalo Chicken Wing has grown enormously popular since its early days in upstate New York. Now the wing is no longer just a cheap way to draw a crowd and sell more beer. It's an entire industry. Since becoming a hot commodity, wholesale prices on this throwaway have risen. And as Rachel Ward of member station WXXI reports, that's making it harder for restaurants to keep them coming.
The Anchor Bar in Buffalo, New York is the home of the original Buffalo Chicken Wing. It's often imitated but never duplicated, according to current owner Ivano Toscani, who inherited the chicken wing dynamo from the original owners, the Bellissimos.
I remember when wings, they used to throw them away. Teresa Bellissimo used to use wings. They used to give it to her. She used to make soup. And when the famous night back in 1964 when she received these wings, they were, like she described them, too big and meaty to put on the stock pot.
So instead, Teresa dunked them in a deep fryer and mixed them up with hot sauce and margarine. And the result? An entire industry built around spicing up the lowliest part of the bird.
Buffalo wings. You hit buffalo, you gotta go for buffalo wings.
That's Audrey Chow. Like many before her, she made a special stop at the Anchor Bar on a cross-country road trip. But it's not just Buffalo where you gotta go for wings. It's also Miami, Detroit, and Seattle, and everywhere in between. Wings have spread, and with that popularity comes a higher price, according to Toscani.
You know, every time that there is Christmas, wings goes up. Super Bowl, wing goes up. But the problem is they never come down. You know, they go up and they stay there.
U.S. Department of Agriculture data shows that chicken wings were wholesaling at 68 cents a pound at the turn of the millennium. But by last year, that price had more than doubled to $1.47 a pound. And when you go through literally a ton a day, like the Anchor Bar does, that can really add up.
I'm Richard Laub. I'm the spokesperson for the National Chicken Council based in Washington, D.C.
Laub knows a thing or two about chicken. And one of those things is that as the popularity of wings has risen, producers have scrambled to keep pace with demand. But while the fortunes of wings are rising, the reverse is happening for mild-tasting, low-in-fat chicken breasts. Prices have slumped for breasts, which used to be the most lucrative part of the bird.
As pricey as chicken wings have been getting until quite recently, they are not enough to carry the bird, so to speak.
So once you've sold the wings, how do you move the rest of the bird? You make perhaps the first innovation in chicken wings since Teresa Bellissimo fried up that initial batch. You give something more or less healthy the full buffalo wing treatment.
I think what you're seeing in the United States is the trend towards what they call boneless wings, which are actually pieces of breast meat that are breaded and battered and cooked in the same way as the wings and served with the same sauce. So it appeals to people who don't like to have, you know, bones in their food or something of that nature.
But this boneless business will not fly with Anchor Bar owner Ivano Toscani.
The wings has bone on it. I mean, you can't get away with it. The other people, they change, they do what they want to do, they want their own identity, they want to establish themselves. God bless them. Do what you had to do. Here at the Anchor Bar, we will continue to use chicken wings, and chicken wings has bones. That's all.
The Anchor Bar is in no danger of closing, but less storied establishments have been forced to close, all because of the high price of chicken wings. For NPR News, I'm Rachel Ward.
A subject that was once taboo is now playing on the big screen in France. A new film portrays one of France's darkest episodes in World War II. It depicts the largest roundup of Parisian Jews, not by the Nazis, but by the French police. Eleanor Beardsley reports.
The film La Rafle, or The Roundup, opens in 1942 in Nazi-occupied Paris. Despite the occupation, life is still relatively good. No one can imagine what's in store for the city's Jewish population. Although they're wearing yellow stars, Jewish children play happily in the streets of Montmartre. But behind the scenes, German officials are demanding that the Vichy collaborationist government hand over 25,000 Jews from the French capital. The raid begins in the wee hours of July 16, 1942. French police storm through apartment buildings, rousing families from their beds. The 13,000 Jews caught in the snare are held for 4 days in an indoor bicycle racetrack in Paris known as the Vélodrome d'Hiver. There is no food or water, and sanitary conditions are appalling. Eventually, they're transferred to French transit camps and then to Auschwitz. Filmmaker Rosaline Bosch said she felt compelled to make this movie.
I wanted to take the audience to the Vélodrome and to those French camps because there are no real photos or films from that time that document it. This film is like a cause for me because no one has confronted this head-on before.
The movie is based on the memories of 79-year-old Joseph Weissman, who was 11 at the time, and one of only two of the 4,000 children held at the Vélodrome to survive. He escaped from one of the French camps. The film includes wrenching scenes where children are torn from the arms of their parents by French guards. Of the 13,000 Jews held at the Vélodrome d'Hiver and then sent to Auschwitz, only 25 would survive. After the war, French governments denied or played down French complicity in the roundup. Henri Rousseau, a historian of the Vichy era, says the film is important for the images it provides.
It's a question of contemporary culture. When an event is not represented in cinema or in the movies or in the TV, it doesn't exist. for many people. Now we have a kind of reference.
The story is not all dark. The film also deals with the often heroic behavior of many Parisians at the time. More than 10,000 Jews were warned or hidden by their neighbors and friends. Eve Monceau, who just saw the film, says she's alive today because of their courage.
La famille de mon père a été sauvée par un policier.
My father's family was saved by a French policeman, a commissioner who was friends with my grandfather, and warned them that on that day they had to get out of Paris.
In the 2 weeks since the film was released, it has generated huge public interest. Jeanine Burgot emerges from the cinema, her face buried in a handkerchief. She says it wasn't an easy film to watch.
I'm so ashamed. I always heard about this, but I never really imagined it. And the children, how could they do that to the children?
The Velodrome was torn down in 1959. Today, there's a memorial to the deportees in its place. The inscription reads, "France pays homage to the victims of crimes against humanity perpetrated by the French state. We will never forget." For NPR News, I'm Eleanor Beardsley in Paris.
Well, coming up today on The World, just after 3 o'clock, the Rio Tinto bribery trial in China causes foreign companies there to reconsider the way they do business. Also, concerns about the internet censorship taking place in Afghanistan and a group of former soldiers in Argentina camps out to demand war veteran status. These stories and more are coming up on The World from PRI and the BBC and WGBH in Boston. That's a little bit after 3 o'clock here on WILL AM 580. Well, you may remember the story of Ella Mae Johnson, which was described at the time of the presidential inauguration. And today we remember Ella Mae Johnson, who has died at the age of 106. She had been a witness to over a century of African-American history, and she was determined to be in Washington to see Barack Obama sworn in as president. NPR's Joseph Shapiro recalls that day and her remarkable life.
When Ella Mae Johnson went to graduate school to become a social worker, this was in Cleveland in 1926, she was the first black student at that school, but she wasn't allowed to live on campus. She was a pioneering professional woman. She made it in the larger world with an air of formality and dignity, but on Inauguration Day, she was willing to look a little silly in order to sit outside in the bitter cold for 7 hours. She sat in her wheelchair, covered from head to toe in a bright blue sleeping bag, with just her round glasses and her nose peeking through. She was in good humor when strangers stopped to talk to her.
Ella Mae, how are you doing in there?
Congratulations.
I'm fine. Now all I need is to rub my nose.
Okay, hold on.
The trip from Cleveland had been exhausting. She talked about what Barack Obama's presidency meant to her.
My hope for him is my hope for the country. If he fails, the country fails. He knows and he says, not me, but you, not us, but all of us.
There was a surprise that came out of that trip to Washington, a book contract. Next month, her memoir will be published. It's called It Is Well With My Soul, The Extraordinary Life of a 106-Year-Old Woman. When the galley proof for her book arrived recently, she picked it up and kissed it. She was proud that she'd leave that legacy.
Ella Mae's real lesson is that compassion is what will get you through life.
Patricia Mulcahy is Johnson's co-writer.
She was orphaned when she was only 4 years old and literally raised by the next-door neighbors. And this incredible example of compassion, outreach, whatever you want to call it, informed the rest of her life.
She'd gotten help from others, too, when she needed money to go to college. But after she graduated, she wanted to turn things around. She wanted to be the one who gave to others. So she became a social worker. She was always reaching out to someone or raising money for some cause. Last year, over Thanksgiving weekend, she had a stroke. She didn't want to let other people take care of her. She'd try to walk and she'd fall. Her friend Betty Miller talks about the loving letter that came from one of her two sons.
He just wrote her a letter, emailed it to me, and then I printed it out, and he just told her she'd been a social worker for years, helping others. She'd been compassionate. Now this is her time to get some help. This is her time to accept the fact that she's 106 years old. She read it, and I said, Ella Mae, do you understand it? She said, I'll try.
There was one last act of determination. When Ella Mae Johnson died Monday evening, she died where she wanted. She was out of the hospital. She was out of the nursing home. She died in her apartment at her upscale assisted living facility. She was surrounded by friends reading her favorite passages from the Bible. Joseph Shapiro, NPR News.
Filing your tax return can be pretty simple.
I'm a confident, capable woman of the 21st century, and I'm going to do this myself.
But it can get overwhelming.
5 hours after messing with TurboTax later, I realized that I actually was not capable of doing this myself, and I needed help.
Deciding when it's time to call in the professionals. That's today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 on WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.
WILL programs are made possible by the Center for Advanced Study, whose Millercom Lecture Series presents Human Rights Trials and Truth Commissions, What the U.S. Can Learn from Latin America, by Juan Mendez on Thursday, April 1st at 7:30 p.m. at the Levis Faculty Center. Online at www.cas.illinois.edu.
Earth and Sky.
From our analysis, probably the most interesting feature of algae is it's a wild card. And so algae might be a big player, but right now it'll take some breakthroughs for us to see that.
You're listening to Daniel Kamen. He's director of the Renewable and Appropriate Energy Laboratory at the University of California, Berkeley, and energy and policy advisor to the Obama administration. Dr. Kamen spoke to Earth Sky about the potential of algae to meet future energy needs.
A variety of algae is actually the common pond scum to various plants. They produce different oils in their cell walls, and they can be very large amounts of it. What we're really talking about is harvesting those materials that look very similar to the kinds of biodiesels that we produce right now.
Kamen said oils from fast-growing algae could either be converted into liquid fuel that could run your car or into more efficient hydrogen fuel. The idea is promising, he said, but the key to success is scaling up the technology.
We can do it in the laboratory, in the Petri dish, no problem right now. The question is, can you do it at scale? And no one really knows.
Kamen added that algae is significantly behind other renewable energy sources like solar and wind in terms of development.
Even if algae performs sort of at its theoretical maximum, it may not be a big enough deal soon enough.
Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Well, taking a look at the weather forecast for Champaign-Urbana and the area from our meteorologist, Ed Kieser, it's calling for hazy sunshine to continue through this afternoon with a high right about where we are, 63 degrees right now on Friends Plaza, and the wind from the east at 7 to 14 miles an hour. Tonight, then, we'll see cloudy skies and a chance of a few showers arriving before midnight. Showers will be likely after midnight, and the overnight low, 42. Wind will be from the east at 7 to 14. Tomorrow, cloudy, windy, and cooler, with rain, perhaps heavy at times, and a high of 47. Wind northeast at 15 to 25 and gusty. Tomorrow night, cloudy, showers during the evening hours, and then we'll clear up. It'll be colder after midnight with a low of 28. Friday, mostly sunny, a little bit cooler, 47. Clear to partly cloudy Friday night with a low around 30. And then on Saturday, partly sunny skies and a high up to 58 degrees. Looking at the two-state forecast for Illinois and Indiana, for tonight, western Illinois, cloudy with rain. Elsewhere, cloudy with rain arriving west to east overnight. And the overnight lows ranging from 36 in far northern Illinois to 50 in the far south. Tomorrow, in the north, cloudy with scattered showers, and elsewhere, cloudy with rain, heavy at times. And highs will range from 45 degrees in northern Illinois to